All right, at first, ensure that we've all silenced our cell phones, and I ask you to please help me welcome John M. from Palm Springs as our speaker tonight.
I'm John, I'm an alcoholic. And I did live in Palm Springs for 5 years. But from right now, I'm living in beautiful Arroyo Grande. And it's nice to see some familiar faces here. Thank you to Lee and to the folks who run this meeting. It is good to be here and good to be able to share a little bit of experience, strength, and hope. Welcome to our new folks. I hope that you don't come in with the same kind of attitude that I came in with. But if you do, just stick around. I want to kind of focus a little bit on something that my sponsor has always, the different sponsors I've had, I've buried two of them now. But all of them seem to focus on steps 1, 2, and 3. Like that was like really important. Because it is. And I realize that more and more the longer I stay sober, if I don't do that on a daily basis, nothing else is really going to happen. It's the foundation upon all the other work that I do. So the quick story is I've been clean and sober since December 31st, 1982. I never intended to get old in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think I really intended to stay. When I came in, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I might have even heard this at this meeting, but I heard a speaker say, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to avoid prosecution. That's why I was here. That's the only reason I was here. I carried at least 3, if not 4 or 5 court cards. I was an unwilling participant. I had a little driving problem was the issue. And I kept getting arrested for drunk driving. But this was in the pre-Mothers Against Drunk Driving days. So my first drunk driving conviction, anybody received a DUI recently? Yeah, approximately what, $12,000 to $15,000? Somewhere in there? 10 to 15,000, yeah. Yeah, 10,000, okay. My first conviction, they fined me $200. And sentenced me to Alcoholics Anonymous 4 meetings. It's pretty serious, you know. That was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know, I guess in the back of my mind, I'd heard of it somewhere. I didn't know much about it except my friend's Uncle Charlie. He was an alcoholic. We knew that Uncle Charlie was alcoholic. And so I called Uncle Charlie and asked him if, you know, he said, yeah, they've got some good AA meetings around here. Come on over and we'll drive over together. So we went over to Uncle Charlie's house and fired up a joint because that's what Uncle Charlie did. And got high and went to the meeting. That's how Uncle Charlie went to meetings. And I thought, you know, this may not be so bad. Yeah. And I assumed, of course, that you were alcoholics. I didn't know anything about it. That you were alcoholics, so you wouldn't even notice. You know, you probably couldn't even tell that I was high when I came in. So that was the kind of youthful stupidity and arrogance that was part of my life. My first meeting, I was 21. What you did do, however, is, and you promised me you would do this, you screwed up my drinking. Because it is really hard, just is even the most basic information. In 4 meetings, I got enough information to know that maybe I didn't drink like all other people. That was enough. That was enough to just be unsettling. And so, you know, I would go on and off. I grew up Catholic, and so there was always the you could, you know, quit for Lent and stuff like that. And, you know, people who have to quit for Lent might want to consider why they have to, but now that's another question, you know. So I grew up in a nice Catholic family. We went to church. Neither of my parents were alcoholic. I didn't realize until I'd been sober here a number of years that I come from generations of Irish Catholic alcoholism. on both sides, aunts and uncles, grandparents, just all the way through, knew nothing about that, of course, because we don't talk about that. And it was just the hidden thing. So it was, even though neither of my parents were alcoholic, they weren't all that impressed or excited with my drinking. My mother, I remember when I was in college, I came home one time and I thought they'd all gone to bed, and I'd come back home from some friends and sitting in their living room, and I had gone out, they had a bar. So I went out of the bar and poured myself a big old glass of wine, and my mom came out and she was kind of surprised that I was sitting there drinking her wine. And she said, go to bed. And so I said, okay, glug, which is what you do with a glass of wine when it's time to go to bed, right? And I just remember this horrified look came over her, like, because it was about 4 ounces of wine, you know? And I got these little messages. My dad observed me one time at a kegger party. I was about 20. And his commentary to me the next day was, John, you know, he wasn't like really concerned, but he just observed. He said, you know, you're kind of a greedy drinker. Which is it's actually not a bad description of a budding alcoholic, you know? Because I was doing, I haven't been to a kegger in a long time, but back in the day, you had to keep the keg pumped up, you know? And so I was going to be of service to the group. I was the guy who was over there making sure them, you know, making sure the pitchers were full. And you could think of it as being of service, or you could think of it as an addict, you know, protecting his supply, which is really what it was. You know, we can have fun here as long as I've got mine. And that's kind of the way my drinking went. So drinking was a lot of fun. I wouldn't have done it if it wasn't. It allowed me to get out of myself, to be somebody that I wasn't. I was kind of, even though I'm an extroverted person, I never really felt like I fit in. I was a second shortest kid in my class through most of high school, and I was a year younger than everybody in my class. So when I'm in high school and they're all getting their driver's licenses, I'm still 15. You know, so it's just, I always felt a little less than. But when I found drinking, it was that magic thing, you know, where everything just came together and said, okay, I can fit in now, you know? And I learned how to be a chameleon drinker. You know, wherever we were, I could kind of figure out, and I realized this is one of the gifts of coming from generations of the family disease of alcoholism, is I was really good at just kind of reading the situation and catching all the cues and figuring out what was, you know. So if we're sitting at some upscale bar down by the airport, you know, I'm Mr. Upscale Bar at the airport, you know, drinking cocktails. And if we're in some little toilet shithole downtown Santa Ana, pounding brews, I'm doing that, you know, and whatever I could fit in. And alcohol was just an amazing thing. I better get this out of the way. My drug of choice was alcohol. But I did a lot of drugs. I realized this, they talk about that hole in the soul. You know, I didn't know I had a hole in the soul, but I knew that I needed to fill that empty space within with whatever. And so, even though my drug of choice was alcohol, my real drug of choice was, what do you got? Because whatever you had, that's what I'm going for. As long as you're willing to do it. Alcohol was always there, and alcohol was what got me into trouble. But I don't know how controversial this is. I have a lot of opinions on just about everything. And I know as a fellowship, we don't have any opinion on outside issues, but you know, I always do. But I just don't know that, for me, that drugs were an outside issue, you know? They're, as my sponsor told me today, no, they're an inside issue. You take them, you know? I think politics is an outside issue, you know? We would not be here today in this nation, as in the kind of controversies that are going on, if we were ever to dip our toes into politics, right? Or religion. You know, I come from a religious background. You know, I don't mind sharing this part of my story, but thank God you don't have to believe what I believe, right? Because here's another thing I figured out, the genius of AA is, I might, through the course of sharing a little bit tonight, you might kind of figure out what I believe in, but I'm not here to share my beliefs. I'm just here to tell you my story. And over the course of that story, you might be able to figure out some of the things. But if I stood up here and told you what I believed, here's what would happen. Immediately, you would have to decide whether you agree with me or disagree with me, and the war is on. And that's what happens in the world every day, everywhere I go. People express an opinion, I'm for it or against it, and there's war. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't do that. We don't share our beliefs or our opinions. We tell our stories. And that's it. You know, you may not like my story, and it may not edify you, and you may get nothing out of it, but that's okay. You know, that happens all the time in AA. On the other hand, even though we don't share anything in common, you may feel some of the feelings I felt. And that's the real gift of recovery. I got clean and sober in 1982. At that moment in my life, I was in my second year of theological studies at St. John's Seminary in Camarillo, where I was studying to be a Catholic priest for the Diocese of Orange, which is down in Orange County. I had gone into the seminary dry. I had had 3 drunk driving convictions. I had come to the conclusion, finally, that I was, in fact, alcoholic. But what I did with that was I went to AA meetings because I got sentenced there, and I knew that these are people who don't drink. And I got over the fact that there was a lot of stuff I wasn't going to do in AA, but I didn't mind going to the meetings because there were some really funny people. And that's what I enjoyed. There were some real clever people. I would hear things that just made me laugh, that kind of got my attention. I remember the first time I ever heard, there's only 2 things you need to know about God. You've heard this, yeah. 2 things you need to know about God. There is one and you're not. I thought that was hysterical, you know. And I go back and tell all my friends at the seminary, you know, and they laugh their asses off. But I love those kind of, those little taglines, those humorous things. It kept me coming back, and it allowed me not to take myself too seriously. Because I've got another issue besides alcoholism, and that is I've got an arrogance. Some of it was just from being young, but I'm just pretty arrogant. It continues to this day. I found that if I admit it up front, it's a lot better than you driving home talking about what an arrogant prick I was. You know, just I'll own it. And having said that, it's not as bad as it used to be. I mean, there has been I think there's been considerable progress. But I was young, I was arrogant, and I told you how spiritual I was, right? Right. I'm very, very. Well, I was in the seminary when I mean, for God's sake, I'm spiritual, right? So I'm young, I'm arrogant, and I'm spiritual. Deadly, deadly combination for somebody who's trying to find recovery in AA. It could have killed me. I was very lucky, if you will, that I knew. See, when I finally came to AA and stayed, I knew I couldn't drink. So I took I took the first half of the first step. I skipped the second half. Because if I'm not drinking, my life is not unmanageable. That's the way I thought of it. The second step, we came to believe that power could restore us to sanity. I skipped that one because I didn't like the insinuation that was in there. You know, what kind of person needs to be restored to sanity? I didn't like that, so I skipped it. The third step, you know, it sounded like I'd learned how to say a little prayer as a kid called the morning offering. And the third step sounded like, say, a little morning offering prayer. So I did that. The fourth and fifth step sounded a lot like go to confession. And I knew how to do that. So I'm good so far. See what I've done? I've taken one half of a step. Okay, I'm doing fine. I came to step 4 and 5. They were together. 6 and 7, I nodded. Yeah, I agreed. Step 8 and 9, let's just say I wasn't ready to understand what that was about. So what I did was I went back to a handful of select people and tried to kind of make nice with them, which is really different than making amends. You know, trying to make nice because you never know when you might need them again. You know, it's just, so I was trying to manipulate people, which is another part of my disease, I understand today. So that's how I did step 8 and 9. And then I looked at 10, 11, 12 and nod, nod, nod. And I agreed with all of them. And then I'm ready to go help others. So that's where I was when I was in my second year of theological studies at St. John's Seminary. I was going to AA meetings 3 or 4 times a week. I hadn't had a drink in a couple of years. Felt good. I was young. You know, it's, for those of you who get clean and sober in your 20s or 30s, it's amazing how quickly we clean up. And we feel better, you know? So I felt good. All those things, taking more physical exercise, da-da-da-da, you know. I'm feeling good. I'm very spiritual. I discovered in the seminary that, wow, this is, I think, where God is calling me to do. I loved it. I loved the studies. I loved what I was being called to do. I loved the opportunities I was being given. I discovered I was pretty good at studies, again. I discovered that I was pretty good at, there was a lot of things that I was really finding I was good at. So everything was going great. What I had done when I went there, since I was going to AA and they all knew it, was I just announced to all the staff and the faculty, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that you guys have never had a sober theologian in your midst before, but I'm here to help. And if anybody has any problems with alcohol or any of your spiritual direction people, you know, you can come and talk to me and we can. So I put that out there. Incredibly arrogant, but, you know, I was about 28, 29, just full of myself. And what happened was this. I had to go down and do a little business deal with an old friend, a guy that I had worked for, and he was a cocaine dealer on the side, but that, you know, I was doing this, I was buying a car from him, and when we had done all the paperwork in order to kind of seal up the deal, he laid out a big line of coke, and I just did it. Just like that. And you would have too, come on. If you had only taken 1.5 steps in AA and you hadn't had a drink for 2.5 years, and there it was, you'd probably have done it too. And what I discovered there was, oh my God, everything they're saying is true. I finally understood that notion that I had no defense against it. You know what I'm saying? Because I hadn't done any of the work. I hadn't done anything except not drink. And I felt so much better that I thought I was kind of immune. And I was young and arrogant and spiritual. And it was a real comeuppance for me. And that was December the 30th, 1980. So I've taken December 31st. That's a weird day for your AA birthday, but it's a good one for me because it reminds me of those things and reminds me that's where I came from. This kid who didn't fit in, who was nonetheless incredibly arrogant. Sound familiar? You know? We either think too highly of ourselves or too little of ourselves. And what I've discovered all through the years in AA is I'm learning how to just kind of be okay with me. You know? And it means I need to start focusing and stay focused on steps 1, 2, and 3. So I've got I wanted to look at my favorite page in the whole big book, because it actually gives me a chance to do a little reflecting on those first 3 steps. And this is page 62 in the big book. I think if I only read this one page for the rest of my life, that I could continue to grow spiritually every day. Page 62 is in the chapter How It Works. It's, you know, a page and a half after we all clap and move on. You know, A, B, and C, God could and would if he were soft, boom, we're gone. But it actually goes on from there to talk about the third step. Being convinced of these things, we're at step 3. So this is just an opinion, but I've conflated steps 1, 2, and 3 into a daily practice. I just have to do, I don't see 1, 2, and 3, you know, kind of, they're all together. They work together as a unit for me. And what that means is I need to acknowledge that, well, here's my simple rewrite of the first step. I don't have any more good ideas. That's what step one means for me today. You know, I the argument is over. I'm just out of good ideas, and I don't know what to do. And that rings more true to me than surrender, because see, I'm really great at grand gestures. Oh, I surrender, you know? And I'd like the grand gesture to mean something, but it never does it? It's just a grand gesture. But when I acknowledge that, you know, I don't have any more good ideas. What I'm doing is not working, that's my first step. The second step, it tells me I need to be restored to sanity. Now, clearly this process of restoration is not something that I can do by myself. I cannot restore myself. I saw a picture in I think it was National Geographic, of this restoration that they had done in the Sistine Chapel. If any of you ever seen that, you know, here's the picture of the original one. It's smudged with dirt and grease and candle flame, and then they show the new one. But what they showed was how they did it, and they did it in like quarter inch increments. And they would go in with these little instruments, and they would, because they didn't want to damage what was underneath, so they would just painstaking. Doesn't that word occur someplace in the book? Painstakingly they would remove this stuff. That's the second step process in me. I'm being restored. I have not been restored. I'm being restored, and it's a long, lifelong process. So on a daily basis, I need to be restored to sanity. I need to be restored to I guess I was confused for a long time, because restoration sounds like you want to go back to something you used to be. No, I don't want to be what I was when I was 15. But what I do want to find is I want to reclaim the image of God that's within me, the person that God created me to be. That's what I want to be restored. I want to find out what that is. And I don't even know what that is yet. I thought it was being a priest. So I went to seminary, see? And I got ordained a priest. In 1986, I was ordained a priest for the Diocese of Orange. I had, three and a half years clean and sober now. I did start working the steps. I did start reading the book. I went to a lot more meetings. Things got real different. And I was assigned to my first parish down in Orange County in 1986. And within 3 months of being there, I was totally insane. And not because I was doing anything wrong. What happened is everything in my life changed. Have any of you gone through any changes in recovery?
No.
Yeah. Our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas, right? And it was just all of a sudden I had a new uniform, I had a new title, I had a new job, I had a new home, I had a new boss, I had a new automobile. It's like everything that could change happened like within a week. It was all new, and I thought I'd just kind of cruise in and be the hip young AA priest and everything would be groovy, and it didn't work out that way at all. I ran into this guy called the pastor, and he thought he was in charge, and he was. You know, and I got into, I just immediately, we were butting heads about one thing or another. And it was crazy making. And I remember, that's when I ran into, my first my friend Sister B. Some of you may know her. She was a sister of St. Clair down in the Diocese of Warren. I was about 4 years sober. She was about 7 or 8 years sober. So she had long-term sobriety, you know. And she ran into me right about that time. She thought I was crazy. I mean, I remember one of the first conversations, and I went on and on about that green carpeting and blah, blah, blah. And she really wondered what was wrong with me. And what was wrong with me was, I'm young, I'm arrogant, I think I'm spiritual, and I need to get rebooted in my program. Because by this time, I did have a program. And so what she suggested to me was, she said, let me just make a suggestion. She said, people like us in the religion game, she was a nun, and as a priest. She said, people like us are at very high risk of believing our own bullshit. Some nice little Irish nun says this to me. And she was absolutely right, because people give you all this authority. You know, they come and ask you questions. And she said, so people like us, we might need to go to a few more meetings than some other people. And we talked a little bit about people that we knew in the church who had been sent away for treatment or one thing or another, you know. And of all of these people that we both knew, we couldn't name one other name that was going to meetings regularly. They did go to meetings. I'm not saying they didn't, but didn't have like a regular daily practice. And she just kind of made it clear to me that I wasn't going to have much of a chance if I didn't go to a lot of meetings. So I became willing at about 3 or 4 years, and I started going to a daily meeting. And I did that for a couple years. And mostly it was morning meetings, which meant here's what willingness was. Willingness was not a concept. Willingness was an alarm clock that went off at like 5 o'clock so that I could go to a 6 a.m. meeting. I'm not a morning person. And at this particular, again, the saving grace of this particular 6 a.m. morning meeting in Anaheim Hills at the bank was there were some incredibly hysterical people there. And I can't tell you the number of mornings I'd be out of there at 7, 7:15, and my gut hurt from laughing, you know? And it's 7:15 in the morning, and that's not the way life used to be. When I was drinking and using, life was not funny. There was not a lot of laughter, particularly in the mornings. And so this was a brand new thing for me. So I got into that and started doing it. I went to a lot of meetings. Grateful to Sister B. She became kind of a mentor. I started doing retreats with her. Eventually, I started doing retreats all over. And lots of wonderful things were happening. Anyway, back to page 62. The first words on page 62 are a signal that maybe I needed more help than Alcoholics Anonymous alone could provide, because it kind of picks up on page 61. It says, you know, we are sure that all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave. That's the first words on page 62. I go, yeah! If they would just shape up, I would be so much better, right? That's another program called Al-Anon. And it took me, as a friend said, you know, if you stay sober long enough in AA, you get to go to Al-Anon. So here's an opinion. Here's a little opinion. I learned this when I was out. I got to do a little stint out at Betty Ford Center. And one of the things I learned there, and they said it straight out. They said, you scratch an alcoholic or an addict and you're going to find a raving codependent. Just a little opinion to piss everybody off, okay? I found that to be true for me. If they all shape up, I still have that feeling sometimes, you know? Why can't they just get it together? So, this page, I counted it up, and it says 13 times on this page, it uses the word self, you know? Ourselves, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, self-will, selfishness, on and on and on, all through this page. It's just the problem of self. And of course, anybody who's been around AA for any number of months at all knows that there are some great lines that we quote here. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the... right, see, we know how to... We can actually just chant these words out. Selfishness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, we step on the... This is, and they retaliate. Damn, they do. Yeah. Yeah. Here's the one that I have. I actually have this. Maureen can tell you. It's in the bathroom where I go in for a little morning leak, and it's right there where I can see it first thing in the morning, and it says this. We invariably find, where is it here? Yeah, we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. I have that enthroned there. Because this 36 years clean and sober, that is as true today as it was the day before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I invariably find that at some time in the past, I've set up a situation which put into motion things that now piss me off. And before, all I would do is blame them if they'd just shape up. Now, I have tools to recognize, I better go back and look at what it was that I did in the past which set me up to be in a position where I'm hurt right now. That, I think, is one of the most important pieces of work that I've been doing in recovery over these years. You do that in an inventory, you do that in going to meetings, you do that in talking to sponsors, you do that in reading the book. All of this is information that has helped me, and I hope will help you, to realize that I've created my own misery. Most of it. There's another place in the book where it says, avoid then the deliberate manufacture of misery. It sounds pretty obvious, doesn't it? You know? And yet, when I look back, that's exactly what I've done. I went out of my way to set up a situation which eventually came back around and kicked me in the ass. And what I used to do is I'd go, what? What? What happened? Why'd you do that? Huh? As if I had no part in it, see? Until I could go back. And sometimes I'm talking years later, where I would be doing another inventory and go, oh, yeah. So when I started this relationship out doing this, and that became the pattern, then all those years later, clearly, okay. And I could never have come to that on my own. And if you had ever tried to tell me that, no way, I'd shut it down. I'm not listening to that crap. Nobody's going to tell me, right? But we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. That's an important part of my ongoing recovery, and I don't want to continue to be a victim. Now, that may sound a little crazy, but I read this in an Al-Anon book, and it said this, resentments mark the places where I choose to remain a victim. Resentments mark the places where I choose to remain a victim. And when that one just stabbed me right in the heart, you know? Because first of all, I hated the fact that I was a victim or that I was remaining a victim, but it was true. And that was the cause of my resentment. So, any resentment that I have today, I look at it and realize, oh, that's what's happening there. That's what's happening. And I've done resentment inventories ad infinitum. Have you done them too? Till you're just sick of yourself? You know, I know my defects of character so well, I'm up to here with it. Maybe then I might need to do a little more work in step 6 and 7 about my willingness to look at some of these old ideas. There's stuff that I couldn't look at till I was 32 years sober. You know? Stuff that I just couldn't do it. I wasn't able to look at it. And so our troubles we think are basically of our own making. Yeah. Is it true? So, true or false? Our troubles today are basically of our own making. Yeah. I think so. Yeah, I think so. And if I could just say that out loud every day when I'm in the midst of my troubles and I'm pissed off and I'm slamming stuff around and Maureen better get out of the way and all that, I'm doing it to myself. See, it isn't about them or her or it or in the world or politics or religion. It's just me. All of this is going on between my ears. See, here's another thing I learned when I was out at Betty Ford Center. I've got a brain disease. Did you know that? That doesn't say that anywhere in the big book, but it does say the problem of the alcoholic centered in his mind. Well, they've been doing a lot of research on the brain, and what they discovered is that the brain of alcoholics, the problem in the brain has nothing to do with, I thought, you know, we used to talk about wet brain. I thought that literally the alcohol had just soaked the brain so badly that that's not quite how it works. In fact, what it does, it's the same thing that every other addiction does. It sets up a dopamine receptor party in my brain that I'm going to do whatever I can to get more dopamine to feel good. For an alcoholic, that means drinking alcohol. It might mean acting out sexually. It might mean any number of things. For the cocaine addict, it's this. For the, you know, but it's the same. That's what goes on in the brain, okay? So I've created these deep neural pathways in my brain based on this disease that I've got. It's behavior that I've done over and over and over and over again. And when those neural pathways light up, watch out, because bad stuff is going to happen. So my recovery has been all about creating some new pathways in my brain. Be warned, the old ones don't go away, ever. They're still there, and when they light up, I have no more defense against them today than I had back then. I do have some practices, and oh, by the way, there is a diversion course over here. There's another pathway in my brain, you know, and it can happen as quickly as picking up the phone and calling a sponsor. It can happen as quickly as showing up in a meeting. It can happen just, you know, boom. I've changed that pathway in my brain. So I know that this is a fatal disease, but I also know that I've been given some tools here. So these problems arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of
self-will run riot.
Isn't that beautiful? I love that. And I've always loved that. There's something about that phrase that just sums it up so beautifully. I am extreme. Yes, I love that. Don't you? Don't you just revel in that? Don't you think that's part of your personality? Don't you? You know, I mean, it's just, yeah, that's who we are. Huh? They're not saying it in a very positive way. They're saying extreme example of self-will. Okay, we've got a little self-will problem. But it's not just a little self-will problem. It's a self-will problem that has now run riot. Have any of you ever been in a riot? No. Have you ever seen one on TV? You know, where they have the helicopters and they're going, there's a fire over there, and bang, somebody's breaking into a plane, and boom, there's gunshots over here. And nobody knows what's going to happen next. Sound familiar? Nobody knows what's going to happen next. And then all hell breaks out over here, and then somebody comes in. That's what goes on in my brain. Sometimes on a daily basis. Not when I'm in a meeting, but just as I'm driving. Or when I hear some news on the radio. This is all going on. There's literally a riot breaking out of my brain. All this stuff is going off. Okay? It's crazy. It's insane. And I've got to rush over and see that. And, you know, riots are not good, safe places. See? But here's the other thing about the after effects of a riot. If you happen to have ever driven down South Central Los Angeles after the major riots there of 20 years ago now, you still see the residue of those riots. There are blocks. There are buildings. It's still, and that's the work that I have to do from all of those years of alcoholism, and even in recovery, I still have to clean up those messes when my head goes off on a riot. I'm a busy man. You understand? I've got a lot of work to do in recovery. I need to be attentive all the time. Because when those riots are happening in my brain, I'm not ever aware that this is a riot. I'm thinking this is the most important thing in the world right now. I have to attend to this. I need to do this. These people need to hear, you know, and I'm off. If the rest of the world would only behave. Yeah. So, above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. Okay. That's a fact for me. So I've learned that my practice as a program of Alcoholics Anonymous It has to include service. It has to include ongoing meetings. I have to be attentive. I have to be ready all the time. How late does this meeting go? I go to
about a quarter after.
Thank you. Okay. So this is the how and why of it, it says. First of all, we had to quit playing God. I didn't think I was playing God. So, okay, I skipped that. It didn't work. Okay, yeah, okay. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director, blah, blah, blah. Here's the how and why of it. How? How are we going to do this change? Well, first of all, it says I had to quit playing God. What that meant was, I wasn't even sure that I was playing God, but I knew that I was always happier when I got my way. I'm a very smart person. And so I've got some facts to back up my opinions. I'm not just spouting opinions. So when I present all of my research and my opinion, I'm expecting that you would now see it clearly and do it the correct way. My way. I never thought of that as playing God. I thought that as leadership skills. Yeah. I thought of that as, being right. You know, so here's the how and why of it. First of all, I had to quit playing God. That's how I have to do this. Why? Because it doesn't work. It's just that simple. It didn't work. There's so many things that I could argue with in Alcoholics Anonymous, but my sponsor early on, one of the first sponsors I ever had, told me, you know, it's a line you've probably heard, and if you're a sponsor, you've probably used it, where you're listening to a sponsee and they tell you this tale of riot and woe and all this craziness, and you say, so how's that working for you? Yeah, because we're not gonna tell anybody what to do, are we? When you say, how's that working for you? Okay, just checking, you know. Because as long as it's working even 1%, you're gonna keep doing it. If it's working even in your imagination, it's still working, you're going to keep doing it. Until finally, I come to step one again, and I say, I don't have any more good ideas. This is not working. I don't know. See how I circle back to step one all the time? Daily, I've got to come there. Daily, I've got to arrive. So that's the how and why of it. And it goes on to talk about God, how God has done all these things. See, I was working for God, so this is a problem. Because I'm young, I'm spiritual, I'm arrogant. I work for God. I got into a lot of trouble because I was playing God, even though I didn't know it. And so here I am, I'm a very happy priest, but I'm getting into all these collisions with people about their opinions. And I was a few years a priest, finally got somebody who pulled me aside after a meeting and just gently pointed, because nobody really talks very honestly to a priest. They try to suck up and stuff like that. They gave me a lot more authority than I deserve. But somebody took me aside after a meeting and they said, you know, that idea that you had about how we should do blah, 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 you know, that might be a good idea, but, you know, if other people in that meeting, you know, get hurt or they get walked on, it doesn't really matter if your idea was very good. You know, if people are going away hurt, and I realize, oh, yeah, you're probably right there, you know? Because I was thinking that the most important thing was doing it my way, because I was right. And so if people got hurt or they got in the way, well, you know, that happens. And I started to realize that there was more to the world than just what was going on between my ears. This is an ongoing process. And so I learned probably the best thing I got to do as a priest was I got to take all the wisdom that I heard in AA meetings. And I got to translate it. And then I would share it with the good people who came to church on Sunday. And I discovered that if I didn't say alcohol or 12 steps or AA or anything like that, but just talked about like the things we like resentment and stuff. People were, I mean, they listened. They listened in the same way that we listen, because I was able to share from experience, you know, how these things have worked in my life. And it's amazing. People were hungry for this stuff. You hear people say, you know, these 12 steps could work for it. It's true. It's true. And there's nothing in the 12 steps of AA that is new in the world of spiritual living. These are ideas that have been around forever. This, my mentor and great spiritual teacher, Richard Rohr, calls it the perennial tradition. The perennial spiritual tradition. It's always been there. Every religion, everywhere, and every time, in every place in the world, there are these basic universal truths that we stumbled onto. Bill Wilson found them and was able to present them in a way that they made sense to drunks. It's amazing. It really is an amazing, because we, let's be honest here, and we're only 85 years out from the foundation of this amazing enterprise. We are the most pathetic, pitiable people on earth. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Isn't that beautiful? I mean, we know what it feels like on the inside, but the world looking at that is not impressed. They had one place for us, the insane asylum, because that's what our behavior looked like. Now, we don't have many asylums left anymore, so where do we find all the alcoholics and addicts now? Jails and prisons, of course, because we can't be safely outside. We can't. We are pathetic human beings with no willpower. Have you, even in recovery, looked at an alcoholic and just shook your head? You know better, but you look at him anyway and you just go, what the? You know? They're lying in their own piss, and it's funny, but it's not. It is not funny. It's you and it's me, right? I mean, maybe mine wasn't that particular flavor of, you know, debauchery, but you know, we've all been there. And so what we've been given is this amazing gift. 85 years Alcoholics Anonymous has been around, offering hope for pathetic human beings like you and me. Now, I don't like to think of myself as pathetic, but I promise you, whenever I see a newcomer walk into our room and I realize how much courage it took for them, because I remember how much courage it took for me. Well, I don't even know if I didn't have courage. I don't know what the hell. I was there on a court card. Well, you know. But when I see that, I'm reminded that this is a very fragile gift that we've been given. And once you've got 30, 60, 90 days, 6 months, 9 months, who had 9 months to, you know, amazing, isn't it? It's just, you know. And at a year, 18 months, you're feeling like, oh my God, I can't believe I used to live that way. And you could turn it all around tomorrow and be right back there. I am under no illusion that at 36 years clean and sober, that I'm somehow immune. I have met too many, I've seen too many people in this fellowship go out after multiple years. And let's look at what's happening to people. Medication and surgeries takes a lot of our fellowship out. We need to talk about that. I'm not a medical person, but I know that if there's prescription medication involved, I may need to get a couple of opinions and talk to some friends in recovery. Not that I need them to tell me what to do, but I know it's a very slippery slope. It's very tenuous. So I need to look at that. I also know what relationships can do. So let me do the quick story. So I was a priest for a long time, okay? 1986. And around 2004, I was having a midlife crisis. And I was crying all the time. pay attention. If you find yourself crying all the time, or, you know, you might want to. So I got a lot of help. I had a priest support group. I had a therapist I was seeing. I had a really good sponsor. I had my men's stag group. I had 4 or 5 AA meetings that I was going to. And I was just kind of falling apart. I wasn't doing anything wrong. I was just sort of falling apart. And finally, I said out loud what was bubbling up inside of me. And what was bubbling up inside of me was, you know, as much as I've loved doing this job, I think I've done everything I can do as a priest. And if you happen to have grown up Catholic, that you're not supposed to think like that. And if you do think like it, you're not supposed to act on it. And so I sought out some extra help. And I went into a period of discernment, really prayer and meditation and seeking. And what am I supposed to do? And at the end of that year, I finally said, I've done what I can do as a priest. And I said my last mass as a Catholic priest in October of 2004 and left the priesthood. It was the most painful thing I'd ever done in my life because I loved what I was doing. I love what you had given me and the way I was able to integrate this and really help people try and stay on a spiritual path for themselves. I love the people that I met in AA, you know, who really helped me to grow. So it was a real, real painful process. And I was grieving deeply and I knew that, but I also immediately jumped into a relationship. You know, I'd been trying to be celibate for 18 years. So I knew this woman for a long, long time. And, you know, we're pretty much instantly hooked up. And within 16 or 18 months, I'd moved up here to the Central Coast and we got married. And 16 months later, I filed for divorce. I stayed sober through all this, okay? But what I was completely unready to be married. Let's just acknowledge that they hadn't taught me much in the seminary about how to be married. Yeah. So I was absolutely unprepared to be in a relationship. So it's not on her at all. But when that happened, the sense of shame and guilt was overwhelming and grief. Just the grief. You know, I'd left half my life I'd been a priest, and I'd left that behind. You know, and if you leave the priesthood and you get married and happily ever after, okay, well, that's, tie it up with a bow, and that's kind of nice. But now I'm used to be a priest, and I'm divorced. Oh, man. And it was just, it really, really broke me down. Lee and a few other people in this room remember I was going to meetings around that time, and particularly at the men's stag, you know, if I got called on, I'd just start blubbering. That was the best I could do. You know, I I'd been sober 25 years at that point, 20-something years, and I didn't know what to do next. An amazing thing happened here. The men of Alcoholics Anonymous kind of just circled me. You know, they kept me in the center of the herd, is the way I've heard it said since. And I didn't even like some of these guys, but there they were. You know, they're just kind of keeping me, and I'm really grateful that they did that for me, because I was very, very vulnerable. I wasn't thinking about taking a drink, not interested in that at all, but just so broken down and so confused and so ashamed and so full of grief. There's one unspoken word in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nowhere in this book does it mention the word grief and loss. And I think, it's just an opinion, it's the big missing piece for a lot of us with long-term sobriety. We've never done any grief work. You don't have to. You could go through all the 12 steps, take them forever, never look at your grief and your losses ever, and be a good, sober member of AA, but you're a little crusty maybe. Maybe just a little hard around the edges. Maybe, and I've met guys like that. They're wonderful, sober guys, but I really don't want anything they've got. They're just a little, because what I found is that when you go through a grief process, it just takes a lot of the sharp edges off. It really softens you up. It makes you a whole lot more aware of other people's suffering. And so that was a great gift to me at that point in my sobriety, to go through that season of grief and to realize, boy, that's changed me more than anything. So I'm living up here in the Central Coast. Life is good. I'm actually, my job up here when I first had left the priesthood, I moved up here to follow her. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I got a job working as a spiritual counselor for a hospice agency in San Luis Obispo, doing spiritual care for hospice. So I was in touch with the grief, you see? I was right in the right place at the right time. Finally got in touch with all of that. And I find that was a great opportunity for me. Things began to settle down. I got settled in here in the Central Coast. I was living in Grover. Life was good. I was doing hospice work. Couldn't have been better. Everything was great. I was over the divorce. I was starting to date, you know, an ex-priest with an ex-wife and now an ex-girlfriend or two. You know, but that's not the story that I had written. That was not the way it was supposed to go. But things were starting to settle down. And then out of the clear blue sky, literally, I got an email from a guy I'd known. And he said, I want you to come out and check out this position. I think you'd be perfect for it. And I didn't, it was out in the desert and I didn't want to go. You know, I was happy with what I was doing. I wasn't looking for a job. Life was settled down after everything had gone on. Let's see, what is it? 2004, I left the priesthood. 2005, I moved out to the high desert up in Juniper Hills. 2006, I connected with her. We moved up here. 2007, I got married. 2008, I got divorced. 2009, I had prostate cancer. 2010, starting to breathe again, okay? Yeah. In 2011, I got this email, and basically, I was offered, just out of the clear blue sky, the position of Director of Spiritual Care at Betty Ford Center. Now, I'm not as young, but I'm still spiritual and I'm still arrogant. And that really talked to my ego. Yeah. I said, oh, you know, the part of me going, oh my God, I couldn't do it. And the other part is, yeah. Now this fits. All right, this will be a good fit for me. And I was delighted. And I had nothing to lose. Packed up and went out to, I lived in Palm Springs for 5 years. That's where I used to live. Working at Betty Ford Center. Got a great education there. You know, treatment works. And what we were doing there and what most treatments are. Treatment works as long as we get people into recovery. Get them into the rooms, right? Yes, it's a very expensive big book, but it works, okay? And unfortunately, like so many things, it came to an end. That was just before they got bought out by Hazelden Corporation. And so in the run-up to the buyout, they eliminated my position and my department and everything. And so suddenly, I'm literally being escorted off the grounds by the director of HR. You know, yeah, I mean, really, I'd gone over to the office on some other thing, and they said, you're eliminated. And by the time I got back to my office, they had locked me out of the computer. Here's a box, get your stuff, we'll walk you out. They walked with me to my car. Yeah. And your badge. And your parking pass, thank you. And I'm going, I'm the director of effing spiritual care. What do you think I'm going to do? Well, really, really, what do you think I'm going to do? God. But it was a humiliation that I needed to go through. I needed to experience what that was like. That one really hurt. And of course, I'm over it now. You can tell there's no resentment there. Yeah. Uh-huh. But it was a good learning. It was a really good learning, and I'm grateful for that opportunity. And when I came back, I had an opportunity to come back up here and do spiritual care for hospice again, I jumped on it. This is apparently what I'm supposed to be doing. It's not a grandiose job, it's working. You know, here's the cool thing. Every patient that I go to see, they're all step one. They're going to die. That's why they're on hospice. They're going to die. Whether they say it out loud or they acknowledge it, you're at step one. And it's just such a great reminder that these principles are universal. You know, I am grateful that there are so many gifts I've been given in this. When I was looking at page 62 before I came, I realized, you know, over on page 63, there's the beginning of all these promises. You guys read the promises at some of your meetings, you know. Those are the promises that come after the eighth and ninth step, right? But there's promises all the way through the book. Sister B pointed these out to me years ago. You know, here's the promises of the third step. We passed through a new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. I hope if you didn't catch anything else, my story has been a series of remarkable things. Some good, some bad, but remarkable. Not at all the script that I had written. We had a new employer. Oh, I only thought I was working for them. I'm actually working for a higher power. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. I'm going to have everything I need. Maybe not everything I want, but in this moment, right here in this moment, I have everything that I need. We've become less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. Do you ever do that? You make some plans and designs? Huh? And it says we're going to be less interested in those things. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. Now, when I first read that, I had no interest in contributing to you. I thought you should contribute to me. You know, I didn't understand what that was about. I heard someplace that there's two kinds of people. There's the kind of person who walks into a room and goes, "Ah, there you are." And there's the kind of person who walks into a room and goes, "Here I am." See, and in my early life, I was that guy. And I want to be the person who walks in and says, "There you are. What can I bring to life?" Seeing what I could contribute. I felt new power flow in. We enjoyed peace of mind. These are promises. We discovered we could face life successfully. Wow. I was looking at this newcomer today at one of my home groups up in the San Luis Obispo Melody meeting on Saturday. And a guy came in. He's been in and out and in and out and in and out. And he's got about 4 months now. And he was looking me in the eye. It was amazing. It was just because he's been so beat down, so ashamed, so recycled. You know, some of you were in that, and to see him just eye to eye was just such an amazing gift. These are promises. He could face life successfully. We became conscious of God's presence. That's what I try to do in my morning meditation, just to be aware that it's not me. I'm not it. This is not me, you know? We began to lose our fear. These are promises. We began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter we were reborn. And that is, those are just promises of the third step. I need to stay focused on those three steps on a daily basis because that will point me in the direction of the tools that I have to use. But if I don't start there, My two sponsors that I've had previously, they always made a point of talking about steps 1, 2, and 3 and how important they were. And just the other day, I was talking with my current sponsor who just lost his wife. Say a prayer for Joan. She was a longtime member of Al-Anon up in San Luis Obispo. And there's going to be a memorial for her next week. Anyway, when we lose people that we love, you know, things change. What was I saying? I was talking to Tom, and he reminded me that how we start our day is probably the most important thing for us, and especially those of us who've been sober for a while. But I think for anyone, how I start my day. And so I've been challenged again to look at how I have started my day. What is the first thing I do? And I realized that I'd kind of slipped a little bit. I was doing a morning meditation. That was fine, but that wasn't the first thing I did. And I needed to go back and say, before I even get there, I need to start with a third step prayer. And here's the simplest form of the third step prayer for me is just the one line out of that third step prayer. Relieve me of the bondage of self. All those times on page 62, it talks about what the problem is. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Relieve me of the bondage of self. I have received in Alcoholics Anonymous the incredible gift of freedom from the bondage of self. And I keep crawling back into the cage. It's crazy, isn't it? Why would you do that? I know better. But that's those old neural pathways. That's the way, you know. So I need to do these practices so that I can continue to be relieved of the bondage of self. Thank you for your attention tonight. And I hope, especially for our new folks, give this a try. Give it a try. All you got to do is show up. You don't have to believe in God. You don't have to do anything. Just show up. If anybody has a problem with the whole God thing, please be assured, as a priest for almost 20 years, you can successfully take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't care what you believe. And you don't have to believe anything, and you can stay sober. All right, thanks.
All right, one last round of applause for John. Thank you.